From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up 150 years ago today, 100,000 people attended President Abraham Lincoln's funeral in Springfield, Illinois. We will revisit that history on the final stop of our series, Tracking the Lincoln Funeral Train.
But first, we go to the presidential news of today. Today in Detroit, retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson announced he'll seek the Republican bid for president. This morning, Carly Fiorina, the former chief executive of Hewlett-Packard, announced her candidacy on Good Morning America. And former governor of Arkansas, Mike Huckabee, is throwing his hat into the ring, crowded with them, tomorrow. NPR political editor Domenica Montanaro joins us. And Domenica, start with Ben Carson. He's never held elected office, but very appealing for many conservatives. Just tell us more about him.
Well, he's a long shot, but you're right that he has tremendous appeal from many conservatives, especially among those supportive of the Tea Party. Any Tea Party event I've gone to or any Tea Party supporter I've talked to or met with over the last several years, when they hear what I do, the first person they ask me about all the time is Ben Carson. And he's a very unique personal story, of course. He was a renowned neurosurgeon at Johns Hopkins University, where he was director of pediatric neurosurgery. He did that for 30 years, and he was actually the youngest person ever to head a division at Hopkins. He's also African-American, grew up in inner city Detroit, and that's where he made his announcement today. He first turned heads on the political stage, though, when you talk about where he came from 2 years ago, with his remarks at the National Prayer Breakfast. With President Obama, he was just sitting just two seats away from him. He criticized his approach to health care, and he said the country was suffering from, quote, moral decay and fiscal irresponsibility. The Democrats and the White House thought that was inappropriate, but it made him look like a fighter in the eyes of conservatives. So that's where a lot of his appeal comes from.
Yeah, he not only criticized the president's health care, he said it was the modern-day equivalent of slavery, which, of course, you know, really resonated, being two African-Americans.
Absolutely.
Move on to Carly Fiorina, the first and perhaps only woman in the Republican field when the dust settles right out of the gate. In her video, she challenged Hillary Clinton. She showed a clip of Clinton and then a clip of herself, Fiorina, saying that the founding fathers didn't intend for there to be a professional political class. So more for those who haven't been following her.
And that's no mistake that she hit Hillary Clinton,
right,
being the only woman who's likely to run in this race that's not named Hillary Clinton. She's the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, and she sees being the only other woman as a lane, frankly. When you have a fairly homogenous Republican Party, Ben Carson and Fiorina offer an opportunity for more diverse voices. And, you know, for Fiorina, she's also a long shot. She doesn't register very strongly in the polls, but she's gotten pretty good reviews so far from conservatives on the way she's talked about Hillary Clinton, the way she's talked about foreign policy. And frankly, this might be an opportunity for her to audition for a VP spot to blunt the effect of a woman in a general election.
Yeah. Mike Huckabee expected to toss his hat in tomorrow again, but he's been out of the political world for a while. He's worked the last several years as an analyst for Fox News, although you tell us that he had a lot of buzz in the Republican primaries a few years back. So tell us more about what would have to go right for him to get the nomination.
Well, it's been really interesting to watch his rollout so far because he actually has a pretty good reservoir of support still in Iowa. You'll remember he won the Iowa caucuses in 2008, which was a surprise for many, but not much of a surprise for those of us who followed him because very affable on the campaign trail, very good campaigner. He does not like raising money, though. This is somebody who has admitted that he doesn't like having to ask for money, and that's always been a problem for him. But he's a social conservative. Iowa is a place where he, you know, could once again, you know, see some of that support and maybe have a chance to win. Plus, he's now saying that he's seen the Clintons up close, and that's going to be a fascination for a lot of activists,
right,
to draw a contrast between him and the Clintons.
Domenico, pick one issue that, I mean, on the left, we see Bernie Sanders jumping in to run against Hillary Clinton. Candidates going to have to see who can lean further to the left to support the working American.
Uh-huh.
Just in the few seconds we have, what will be the debate among Republicans?
Well, I mean, I think that there is going to be an income inequality message, no question about it. And Mike Huckabee talks about his blue-collar roots. Ben Carson talks about that, too, having grown up in inner-city Detroit. I think that foreign policy, though, is the one issue where we've seen a lot of Republicans now start to talk about that. And a poll out today showed that foreign policy was the top issue for Republicans as well.
Okay. Domenico Montanaro, NPR's political editor, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, if you've been listening in recent days, you know we have been tracking Lincoln, tracking the route of President Lincoln's funeral train 150 years ago from Washington, D.C. to Springfield, Illinois. Well, on this date in 1865, the president's funeral drew more than 100,000 visitors to the Springfield Oak Ridge Cemetery. And in the final installment of our series looking at Lincoln's impact on the lives of modern Americans and his legacy on race relations, Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd reports from Springfield, Illinois.
A freight train rolls past what's now an unremarkable spot in Springfield, but in the summer of 1908, this entire area was ablaze with a race riot. Curtis Mann from the city's Lincoln Library is giving me a walking tour of the neighborhood.
The street we're walking down right now in 1908 would have been an area that was known as sort of the red light district of Springfield.
Correct.
Where gambling and prostitution happened.
Yes, it was the levee district. And just off of the levee district was the residential area known as the Badlands. And as the rioters finished pillaging and burning the black-owned businesses in the levee district, then they moved towards the residential area that they knew where a large number of African-American families had lived.
The white rioters sought revenge against two black men accused of assaulting two white residents. The violence lasted 2 days and left seven people dead. At the time, Maddie Hale was a teenager living outside of town. She remembers black families fleeing the city as it burned.
Some went to the country with food and clothing in sacks on their backs.
This interview was recorded in 1974 as part of an oral history project produced at the University of Illinois Springfield. Hale told her interviewer that six families rode out the riots in her barn.
A lot of them went up there, stayed all night in the barn loft. Some slept out underneath our trees, our fruit trees, and we taken some in the house.
These riots shocked the country, and they were a catalyst behind the formation of the NAACP. They happened just 43 years after President Lincoln, the man who ended slavery in America, was buried in Springfield's Oak Ridge Cemetery. Curtis Mann says 1908 was a black eye on the city.
The fact that this race riot happened in Lincoln's hometown is ironic. That's not lost on anybody that knows their Lincoln history.
Lincoln's legacy and the race riots of 1908 are certainly not lost on Reverend Martin Wolfe.
Hello.
Hi.
I met Wolfe at his church, the Abraham Lincoln Unitarian Universalist Congregation.
I think we were dismayed to see just how physically segregated blacks and whites are.
Wolfe says that racial segregation in Springfield extends into modern times. So for the past year, members of his mostly white church have been getting together with members of a mostly black church to talk about race.
First of all, they was kind of afraid to let their feelings out because they're afraid to hurt somebody.
Reverend Silas Johnson runs the Calvary Missionary Baptist Church, the black congregation.
I brought up in Mississippi, and coming up in Mississippi, you knew one thing. If you didn't know anything else, that whites were on this side, you was on that side. You knew that they didn't like you, and you knew that you didn't like them, and you did not cross the barrier. They did not smile at you. You did not smile at them. It was just one of those known things.
These conversations among churches can get into complicated territory. But when I visited the group, they told me they started to learn from each other. For example, Stu Jacobson is white. He says hearing about the anxiety that black members and their families felt around police gave him new perspective. And he says he didn't understand why some young black men felt singled out because of the way they dress.
I had old daughters. It's not something that I ever contemplated worrying about, not with it, just them, but if I had friends who had a teenage male, that just, you know, how they dress, if they want to dress a little strange, that's not likely to get them in trouble. It's just mind-boggling that... That's another thing you have to worry about.
I started in this group by accident. I was scared.
Lisa Marley is Black and the group's youngest member. She says she learned something, too. With so much talk around the country about Black men clashing with police, the group invited a police officer to talk to them.
And they gave us this, like, instruction card of how to be non-abrasive with the police and still hold yourself as respectable. You don't have to be the stereotype person where each Black person that got out the car was going to be like, what you want my ID for and all this stuff.
Marley says she learned it's better to stay calm when confronted by police. And recently, she says, she did just that when a cop stopped her and her brother. Staying calm is something she might not have done before.
We were just citizens. We weren't Black citizens, white citizens. We were citizens. And I got that from here.
What Marley and the rest of the group also got was the urge to do more than talk. Last month, they organized a march on the old state capitol. More than 100 people gathered. They rang bells to signify the work that still needs to be done in this country on the issue of race 150 years after the death of Abraham Lincoln. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Springfield, Illinois.
Tonight in Chicago, the James Beard Foundation is holding what's known as the Culinary Oscars, an annual award ceremony in honor of the world's top chefs and restaurateurs, people who really know what they're doing in the kitchen. But what about the rest of us? Turns out, even if you think you're a great home cook, you're probably making a lot of mistakes. Chef Anna Sortoon has been thinking about those mistakes and the simple ways to avoid them. She has won her own James Beard Award for her work at Oleana, one of the restaurants she owns in the Boston area. I walked down to our kitchen the other day, and I asked her to tell us about some of the mistakes we make.
A lot of the times I see overcooked or mushy broccoli because people are steaming it or boiling it a lot. And I have a way of doing it that I love. I think it's foolproof. It comes out delicious every single time, and it's super easy.
And what is it that you do?
Well, some of it is cutting. So you can trim down the broccoli a little bit from the stem, right? Start at the stem and just trim it all the way down until you get to the florets, until you can actually just kind of break it up with your hand.
Uh-huh.
Then you get pieces that are all about the same. And you just do this to each and every section of the broccoli.
And you keep those pieces of the stem.
Yeah, I love them. I think they're delicious. But you want them to be all about the same size so that they cook about the same time. And then what I do is I take a little bit of olive oil and butter. You can use one or the other, but I like to use a little bit of both just to keep things lighter.
There we go. Pouring some olive oil into the pan. Put a little butter in there. Both of them at the same time.
Both in the same time. And then you're going to start to see your butter is going to start to melt here.
Okay.
So I'm just going to glaze it a little bit by taking the broccoli and putting it in the pan.
Not even boiling it.
Not even boiling it. And this is, you can do the same thing with green beans. But what's sort of funny is you're not really sauteing it. You're almost sauteing it first and then you splash it with a little bit of water. To steam it through. And then everything's just glazed and nothing's mushy and you can season it as you like. And it takes much less time than waiting for a pot of water to boil or uh-huh. your steam.
So why do so many people do it the other way and steam their broccoli and then maybe throw it into a pan afterwards?
Well, I think they think it's easier. Or they think there's also a rule of thumb about blanching green vegetables. And some people think that you've got to boil everything that's green. And you actually don't. Not when it's super, super fresh, super good. You don't have to. I mean, this is a great way. And as soon as we get some heat here, you'll start to see how it'll turn dark green. Then you add a little bit of water to your pan. Only maybe a tablespoon or two tablespoons is enough to sort of cook it through.
Well, while we are waiting for that, I know that you also have a pork tenderloin here with you.
I do. I've got... So one thing I think that is a rule of thumb that everyone needs to follow is the cooking is almost nothing compared to the resting. So a really good piece of meat rests for at least 10 minutes. And a lot of people skip that, or a lot of people will sear it really hard and then cut right into it and then not sure why it's so dry.
So after you are done cooking it, you've got to let it rest. You're saying this is something you would do right afterwards.
Exactly.
But before you eat it.
You'd want to sear it. And again, a little bit of butter and oil is always a good rule. If you want to get rid of the butter, you can.
I love how you just put your hand right in the butter and it's so soft.
And then it's always a good idea to dry it because you're about to get, you want to get a nice even brown on
it. You don't want any water on there when you put it in the oil.
No, you want to pat it dry. And I think people forget to do that too. You just want to just, all it is a paper towel on the bottom just to dry it off a little bit. And you don't want to crowd your pan either, and you'll get a nice you'll be able to get a nice browning on both sides. The other thing that happens too is, have you ever like been tempted? So most people, like, they can't leave whatever's in the pan alone. Like, they want to make sure it's not sticking. So they try to check it, and it sticks to the pan, and then they get mad because it sticks to the pan. But actually what happens when things are browning is, as soon as the surfaces are caramelized, it'll turn naturally. So actually when something's ready to be flipped, it won't stick.
Now, you're just putting a little bit of salt on while it's in the pan onto the pork.
Yeah, so I literally just season right as I'm cooking. It's all under control. The other thing I do, too, is I listen to the pan. In other words, this shouldn't be, like, spitting and popping, and all the flames that you see on TV means that you're in trouble.
How does this apply to fish? Is there a total difference when you're cooking fish?
So fish can be a little more delicate. If it's a drier piece of fish like cod, you have to be careful. But if you have an oilier piece like salmon or striped bass, those will render just like this and get a really nice brown side to it. In fact, I brought some scallops with me too. I love to caramelize scallops, and I cook them from the bottom up.
Is that something that's easy to do for most people?
It's easy if you're not tempted to turn them before they say they can be turned.
Well, let's check out, how do you do that with the scallops?
So what I'm going to do with the scallop is I'm going to just put it in. Again, it's a nice, even pan that's not making me nervous. It's not too hot. It's making just the right amount of noise. I'm not afraid of it popping at me at all. So it's really just trusting your instinct. I can even see on this that I can see the edges on that scallop getting brown, which is really, really, really nice. And you want to watch it caramelize almost. You can watch the whole process just from the side if you look at it.
Well, while we are waiting for some of these things to cook a little bit, tell me a little bit about onions, because I know that that's one thing that you think a lot of people get wrong.
Well, I think a lot of people want to leave them out because they're such a pain to chop, and all the crying that happens when you're chopping onions. But to me, they're essential. They're the soul. They're a body. They're sugar. And it's almost like, you know, when you start cooking onions, you're cooking. The whole house smells good. It's like vegetarian bacon. It draws a crowd, you know, and it's really the soul of everything. But it's also a lot of natural sugar that you don't want to give up. So I always say, if you're going to leave something out of the recipe, don't leave out the onion, whatever you do.
But there is no way to get around the crying, right?
Well, there's a lot of wives' tales, but usually when an onion's pretty fresh, just kind of suck it up and get through it.
Now, I have to say, I'm getting nervous about those scallops. How would I know at this point in cooking them that it's not time to flip them?
So basically what I've got is it's white here, and it's still rare in the center, and that's what I'm looking for. And I can see that the bottom, there's like a tiny little crust forming, and once I start seeing that, then I know that it's not going to stick, and I can actually check it.
And you just lift it up with your fingers there.
Yeah, and because my pan is a reasonable heat, it's not smoking hot. And I'm just getting them caramelized nice and slow. See, that one still has some spots on it there.
Uh-huh.
That's not quite as far as I want it to go. And I'm just going to go a few more seconds until it's almost cooked. And then I'm going to flip it for a second, and it's done.
I have to say, it's starting to smell really good in here.
So basically, the broccoli now is cooked when the water has evaporated. And I could have this whole pan full of broccoli, and it would still do the same thing. So, you know, what happens when you start doing the broccoli is you brown it. It starts to turn this dark green and look almost cooked. Add a little bit of water, and this softens the heat and just steams it all the way through. But yet you're not, it's not waterlogging the broccoli. You're not just cooking it in water so it becomes mushy and watery.
So we've got our surf, we've got our turf, we've got our broccoli, and we've got our onions. What about rice? This is something that people cook all the time, or grains, quinoa could be. Are there things that we're doing wrong there?
Well, with any grain, I think sometimes people overcook it. So then you have the same sort of problem that you do with your broccoli. It becomes kind of mushy, wet, heavy. And you really want to give it, what I like to do is slow it down when it's almost cooked. Turn it off and let it finish cooking for the last minute off the heat. And then it just sort of swells, and it almost swells and fluffs at the same time.
So a big message then is just resting. Allow things, when you're done cooking them, to rest for a little bit before that's a part of the process that we often just skip.
Yeah, I think all restaurants, they cook your meat when you order it, then they rest it for 10 minutes, and then it's kind of cooled down because they're smaller portions. It's not a giant roast. Then they just reheat it.
Reheat
it
where?
Perfect.
How do you reheat it? In a
home
kitchen.
You throw it back on the stove
just
and a
for
pan.
A minute or two?
Just to heat it through. Pop it in a toaster oven even. Pop it in the oven. Literally just to get it hot through again.
Uh-huh.
And then when you go to slice it, it won't bleed out all of its juices. But this is its resting stage right here. And what they do in the Middle East, which I love so much, is they rest it on pita bread or flatbread so that not a drop of flavor is lost. And then the best part is that bread after. Yeah, because it's full of meat juices. So resting is a very important thing and a key way to get every piece of meat that you cook to taste better.
Well, Anna, is there any other mistake that we've left out of this discussion that you want people to know that they make and they shouldn't be?
Well, I think anything that you're cooking is never a mistake. So cooking something, you learn from your mistakes, right? So hopefully, I think that mistakes are good because the next time you cook it, you hopefully won't be discouraged. You'll be encouraged to do it, do it better or try to figure out what you did wrong in the first place.
Well, Anna Sortoon, thank you so much for taking us through all of these things. This food looks delicious, and we'll put some of your tips up at our website, hereandnow.org. Anna, thank you.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. I appreciate it.
FBI agents are searching an apartment in Phoenix looking for information about last night's shooting in Dallas outside a provocative contest for cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Two gunmen drove up and opened fire with assault rifles, hitting a security officer in the leg. Another police officer shot and killed the two gunmen. The group behind the contest, the American Freedom Defense Initiative, had offered a $10,000 prize for the best depiction of the Prophet. The group's founder, Pamela Geller, said the event was taking a stand for freedom of speech. But our next guest says hers is an anti-Muslim hate group. Mark Potok is senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center. They track hate groups. And so, Mark, you know, the magazine Charlie Hebdo in Paris also said it stood for freedom of speech. And when shooters killed cartoonists there who depicted the Prophet, people defended the magazine. What in your mind is different here with the American Freedom Defense Initiative holding a cartoon contest?
Well, I think there is a difference. When you look at Charlie Hebdo, the reality is that the vast majority of the targets of their satire, of their lampooning, are not Muslims. They are, in fact, the kind of the rich and the powerful, and much more established. So a very small part of their ire was directed at these very vulnerable people in France. In the case of Pam Geller's outfit, we are talking about an organization which is solely and wholly dedicated to defaming Muslims, and not just radical Islamists, but Muslims of all stripes.
Tell us why you think that.
Well, she describes Islam as an ideology, the most radical and extreme ideology on the face of the earth. She has a whole set of conspiracy theories that go along with that, many of which have to do with Barack Obama, our president. She's described Obama as the love child of Malcolm X. She's promulgated the idea that his mother, posed for a pornographic magazine, that he was involved with a crack whore, that he's really a Muslim, that he wants jihad to win. And so on. And she has specialized in these kind of provocations for a long time. She has published pictures on her own website of the Prophet Muhammad with a pig's face. She posted another video at one point which suggested that Muslims engaged regularly in bestiality.
Well, the list is long, and people might remember that she also started the anti-Islam blog Atlas Shrugs in 2004, but people really got to know about her in 2010 when she led that fight against a Muslim community center near Ground Zero in New York. But
right, which she described as a victory mosque, celebrating the victory of 9/11.
And hers is a group that posted those anti-Muslim ads in major U.S. cities. So how do you square this, though? Because it's also a group that says it's devoted to freedom of speech. And in fact, it was a contest, you know, that expressed the freedom to have an opinion.
Yeah, I would say two things in response to that. One, I don't think Pam Geller's object at all was to promote free speech. It was to bring more attention to Pam Geller, which is unfortunately what this shooting will do. The other thing I would say is that, you know, I and the Southern Poverty Law Center are absolutely defenders of free speech. We are not suggesting in any way that Pam Geller should somehow be muzzled. You know, this, in a sense, is the price of doing business in a democracy. We have to allow this kind of speech.
But you wanted people to know, want people to know about the group. Mark Potok, senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Mark, thanks as always.
60% of the world's population of large plant-eating mammals like hippos and rhinos are at risk of extinction, according to a new study published in the journal Science Advances. Bill Ripple is the lead author. He's a distinguished professor of ecology at Oregon State University. Professor, welcome.
Hello. It's good to be here.
Well, and a pretty incredible numbers there. 60% of these animals at risk of extinction?
Yes, we found, surprisingly, over half the animals that we studied are threatened with risk of extinction. This is mainly due to hunting by humans, land use change, and competition with domestic livestock.
Well, and let's talk about hunting by humans. Is there anything that can be done to stop that? We know this has been a problem for a long time.
Yes, a stricter enforcement of conservation laws and game protection laws would help. This hunting is going on at increasingly higher rates, so it's really important to have the animals protected and to think about getting better protection with law enforcement.
Why isn't that happening now?
I just don't know. I just think that the problem's so big and the poverty is so huge in some of these developing countries that they just don't have the resources to enforcing the game laws.
Well, then on that subject, let's talk about one of the other problems here, which is that there are more livestock and that is taking away some of the food and water that these native animals depend on.
Yes, livestock are increasing around the world, especially in developing countries right now. As they are gaining wealth, the people in these countries want to eat more meat, and this results in direct competition between the livestock and the native animals that need the forage and the water.
And the final reason that you cite in this study is changing land use. Explain that.
A lot of these animals live in forest lands, and the herbivores need these forests for their habitat. But deforestation, logging is going on at increasing rates. This type of logging can be detrimental to the native herbivores.
So, Bill Ripple, for Americans who are listening to this, why does this matter to us, and what can be done about it from the perspective of people here in the United States?
People just love these animals. They have an intrinsic right to exist. But furthermore, these large herbivores are considered ecological engineers, so they all have a role in the interactions in nature. So it's just an important thing to do. We do not want to lose these species.
That's Bill Ripple, a distinguished professor of ecology at Oregon State University. He's the lead author on the study, which we'll link you to at hereandnow.org. Bill Ripple, thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Well, a new young adult book caught our eye. I Will Always Write Back was written by Caitlin Alafarenka of Pennsylvania and Martin Ganda of Zimbabwe and tells of their friendship as kids and pen pals. He writes, how can she have a dog in the house? She marvels that he can know about Nike shoes but live in a hut. What she doesn't know at first is that he can barely afford to write her, once writing on an old food wrapper. Incredibly bright, he soon can't afford school. His country in the 1990s is on the verge of collapse. They wrote the book together, but Caitlin is here to tell their story. And Caitlin, describe your 12-year-old self when this started.
I was, I think, a pretty much a typical American teenager. Loved boys, loved music, loved hanging out with my friends and clothes. didn't really care too much about school. Just liked having fun.
Kind of self-absorbed, as you say.
Absolutely.
So suddenly your teacher's saying we're going to pick pen pals, and the countries are up on the board, and even just the name Zimbabwe fascinated you. What were you thinking?
I had no idea where Zimbabwe was. I had an inkling it was probably in Africa, but it was such a cool name, and I just wanted to learn more about it.
And you start sending the letters. On the other end, Martin is picked out to be the recipient. There's a point in your story when young Caitlin starts to realize, wait a second, there's something going on here. You'd been sending him money.
I did. I was initially showing him our money just so he could see what our money looked like.
Like, here's a dollar, right?
Correct. He wrote back to me after I had sent him, I think it was $20. I had babysat that Friday night, and I sent him money from that. And he said that it fed his family a nice holiday meal. And I couldn't believe it, because I know I've went grocery shopping with my mom, and the bill always gets really high for holiday meals.
Yeah. This started changing you.
Yeah, I felt like my friends at school were more absorbed in things that weren't as relevant, you know, as Martin was, what he was going through in his life. He was actually dealing with real life problems of hunger and poverty. And my friends here were upset if they couldn't get the new Spice Girls CD. Yeah. I started finding out a lot about Zimbabwe and how it was collapsing. The economy was collapsing, and the devastation and hunger and all the political turmoil was taking over. And it really scared me because my friend was there.
Now he's your friend.
Absolutely, yes. He told me that his dad lost his job and that he was cleaning shoes and pouring tea, carrying luggage just to get some money because he was kicked out of school. And that really bothered me, that my friend who wanted to go to school and get an education had a difficult time eating, and he was just a child. And it just really bothered me that my friend was suffering.
Well, you started taking classes about Africa. You realized there was a monsoon season. He might need boots and tarps. You learned that they were plugging holes in their one-room hut with your letters.
Yes, they couldn't have clean drinking water and, you know, wearing no shoes in these monsoon seasons and with all the rain and water. And so I started going to the Army-Navy stores and looking at potable water tablets and tarps and anything I could that would help keep their family safe.
Well, he mentioned no shoes. At one point, you send a box of used shoes. What was his response?
His response was that his mother was now considered to be a human being because she finally had a pair of shoes.
No.
Because people who don't wear shoes are considered just to be animals. He enclosed a letter to my parents, really just pouring his heart out and asking them for their help because he was going to die in Zimbabwe if he didn't have some help just with anything, with going back to school, with food.
Did this feel at this point like, oh my gosh, how did I ever get involved in this? You know, it was supposed to be just a simple pen pal ship, and now I feel burdened maybe by this?
I never felt burdened at all. I felt concerned. He was my best friend. We were totally best friends. We knew everything about each other, and I was determined to do anything that I could to make sure that he was okay.
Well, and how did your parents feel about this?
I'll never forget this night. They sat down with me and they said, what do you want to do? And I said, I don't care what needs to happen, but we need to help my friend. My parents said, you realize if we step in and help, we're going to help 110%. And I said, I can't help him on my own anymore. It was bigger than me. And my parents agreed. And they said, if you feel strongly about this and you want us to do this, then absolutely we'll help.
And eventually, your mother gets him a full scholarship at Villanova?
She worked very hard, my mother. She was at Villanova every single day asking if they had found any money for him. And they did. They got him there.
And Martin Ganda from Zimbabwe, your pen pal from the age of 12, now has dual degrees in mathematics and economics.
Yes, and he's got his MBA from Duke.
Oh, there's that too.
Yes.
And you are an emergency room nurse?
Correct.
Are you still friends?
I actually call him my brother. He's my daughter's uncle. Yes, we're family.
What do you make of it all?
I think this is just extraordinary that we were able to keep a friendship for so long and through so many different obstacles. And I'm thankful because I feel like he has just changed my life for the better. And I know that I did something good and it makes my heart happy.
Well, it also is a cautionary tale about, you know, raising your hand in class when someone says, who wants to do fill in the blank? I mean, if you hadn't, your two lives would not have intersected and you wonder what Martin's would have been.
Right. It scares me to think about what Martin's would have been.
Caitlin Aliferenka, co-author of I Will Always Write Back, a new young adult book about her pen pal, Martin Ganda, and how both their lives were changed. Caitlin, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Some new research from Harvard finds that among the country's 100 largest counties, the place where children have the hardest time escaping poverty is Baltimore, where there are still National Guard troops keeping the peace after riots last week. We want to take a closer look at the study, at what it tells us about Baltimore and upward mobility across the country with Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, who joins us each Monday. Derek, welcome back.
Good to be here.
And first, let's talk about Baltimore. What does the study say about that city?
Baltimore City, as you mentioned, was the worst large county for income mobility for young children. I think we should define income mobility. We hear a lot about income inequality.
Right.
That's the gap today between the rich and the poor. Income mobility adds another dimension, time. Over time, can young people who are born to low-income families work their way into the middle class and beyond? And Raj Chetty and this group at Harvard's Equality of Opportunity Project have been looking at this question for a number of years. This is a huge study, two studies actually, and it found that growing up in Baltimore as a young child in a low-income household reduces that child's earnings more than any other area in the country by about 17% for children that grew up there from birth. So what the study is telling us is that location matters even more than we thought.
And even for people who move, they might be in one city at an early age and then they move somewhere else during their childhood. This study found that the younger children were when they moved, the better off they did. And there was a difference between how boys and girls were affected.
That's right. The value of moving is not just a question of where do we move, but when do we move? How old are the children when they move cities? Because when they did this study, they found that when someone older than 13 switched cities, sometimes that could even be detrimental. You're taking that young boy or girl out of their social group and they have trouble adjusting. But the study did find that if you move with young children, those young children can sort to a good a
place with better upward mobility.
Exactly. The children could soak up the causal effects of that new neighborhood. They benefited tremendously in terms of higher lifetime earnings, more likely to go to school, more likely to be in a dual-earner household or a two-parent household as an adult. So the benefits are really multiplicative here if you move when the children are young enough.
Let's talk about some of the other places that we see this kind of thing around the country. Aside from Baltimore, what were some of the other areas, first of all, where it's hard to get away from poverty?
They found that the places worst in the country in terms of upward mobility tended to be more segregated, had more income inequality, had worse schools. This is really just across the Southeast. If you sort of imagine a swath of land going from, say, southern Virginia, sort of cutting across the Deep South into Alabama and Mississippi, these areas do really, really poorly in terms of income mobility for people born in the early 1980s. On the other hand, there are some cities that have a remarkable track record. Areas like Seattle, Minneapolis, Salt Lake City, Washington, D.C. Here you tend to have shared resources and shared real estate. By that, I mean you have a lot of poor families that are living much closer to middle-income and high-income families, and they seem to benefit from a density of mixing of economic opportunities.
So an urban environment can be a good thing, you're saying, as long as there's kind of mixed economic status and all kinds of people living in the same general area?
Right. Overall, the studies did find that people who lived in suburbs, close suburbs to rich cities on the coast and then cities like Minneapolis in the middle of the country tended to do the best. But what the policy implication of this at the national level is a little bit difficult to tease out because housing policy is so often a local issue. And the key takeaway here is that, you know, you want to integrate disadvantaged families into mixed income communities. You want to find ways to build housing closer to central business districts so that low-income people can live closer to where the best jobs are.
Derek, you look at these kind of issues all the time, both the issues of urban versus suburban versus rural and also income inequality in general. As you look at this study, does this tell you anything about society that you didn't know before?
Yes. I think the thing that it taught me that I didn't know before is that moving isn't just about where you move to, but when you move. This study seems to show very clearly that if you want the best outcome for your child, it's very important to move early into an area with a high demonstrated upward mobility in order for that young child to sort of soak up all the benefits of that place, whether it's the better schools, less segregation, lower crime. You want to introduce young children to these better cities and suburbs as soon as possible. And moving when that child is 12, 13, 14, it at that point might be too late to have a large economic effect on their future.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, and we'll link you to more about this study. You can see where your city or your county ranks up at hereandnow.org. Derek, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.